Welcome to the Mozilla Digital Memory Bank Podcast, a production of the Center for History and New Media.
I'm Ken Albers, and this week we will hear excerpts from an oral history interview with Mozilla developer David Barron that Olivia Ryan and I recorded in June of 2006. Early in the interview, we talked to David about how developers handle and resolve conflicts that arise over code.
Clash kind of sounds like a strong word. We disagree a lot, but I wouldn't use the word clash to describe minor disagreements. I think in general, I tend to be one of the people who's a little bit more perfectionist, in that I tend to work more slowly on things and try to land things that are better tested by the time I'm landing them. Lately, I think I've also developed a strong bias towards having less code rather than more, because I think it's very easy to fix bugs by adding code, even if they could also be fixed by removing code. And you end up much better off in the future if you fix them by removing code. Probably the types of things I've had disagreements with other people over were, you know, whether it was worth adding a lot of code to do something. In other words, is it worth adding 200 lines of code to fix some bug? Even given that we have the 200 lines of code written and tested right in front of us, I sometimes think that we shouldn't take the fix if the bug is obscure enough, because that 200 lines of code is going to need to be maintained in the future, and people are going to need to understand what it does repeatedly every time they have to make a change in code that's related to it. I think a lot of other core contributors actually think the same way, but sometimes people contributing patches don't necessarily realize how high the maintenance costs of additional code are, and therefore expect that if it fixes the bug, therefore it's good and should become part of Mozilla, even if that's not necessarily the way we see it.
David also shared with us his perception of how the Mozilla community has changed over time and the different obstacles volunteers face when trying to gain entry.
So I initially started filing bugs because I was interested in web standards and interested in improving CSS support in web browsers. So I essentially found the things that I thought were important to fix and filed bugs on them. And when I realized how responsive the developers were, then that encouraged me to keep filing more bugs, because I realized that if I filed something, it would actually have a pretty good chance of getting fixed. And, you know, this was back when there were 1,000 bugs in Bugzilla, and, you know, filing another bug, there weren't that many people testing things. So if you filed another bug, then the developers knew about that bug, and if they knew about it, there was a much higher chance they'd fix it than if they didn't know about it. As there have been more and more bugs in the bug system and more people filing bugs, it's essentially that's become less effective, because now there are so many bugs in the system that I can't keep track of all the bugs in the areas that I work on that are in the system. They're often invalid, they're often not clearly enough described, not well enough described to understand what the bug is. But essentially when I started, it was just kind of like walking over to somebody and saying, hey, did you notice this? And they could respond quickly because there weren't a lot of other bugs that they were getting email about. And so seeing how quickly things improved when I filed bugs on them really just encouraged me to keep going and eventually get more involved.
Do you think that the process now for volunteers sort of gaining entry has changed because the community is so much larger, because there are so many more bugs?
I think some things about it have changed a lot, but I think other things about it are really still very similar, in that a lot of it is based on doing work that people notice and recognize so that other people start to trust you to do things. Maybe today you need to be a little noisier about it sometimes. But I think it's still... And the mechanisms for getting through to people have changed. But I think fundamentally the process for getting involved is still do something to prove that you know what you're doing and let people know about it. And the problem is that, you know, for every one person who does know what they're doing, there are also a bunch who try to get involved and try to work on things but don't necessarily know what they're doing. Maybe because they're trying to work on code that they don't understand well enough, or they're trying to work on... I think some in the areas I work on, it's more often that they're working on things where they don't understand the requirements well enough, because the requirements are this whole complex mesh of web standards that all have that are all related to each other in complex ways, and that it really takes a lot of reading and a lot of working with to understand. You know, there's the issue for, you know, new people getting involved. There are always the people who are trying to get involved but aren't actually doing work that we like. And, you know, saying that the thing to do is be persistent is maybe a little misleading, because other people can be persistent and when they're not doing good work just as much as if they are doing good work.
Right.
Later, David discussed how he thinks Mozilla's priorities have changed from Netscape to now.
Yeah, I mean, I was just starting to get involved peripherally about 6 months after it started, so I don't know a whole lot about the priorities then, but I think at the beginning, maybe the priorities weren't all that clear at the beginning, just because... To some extent, it was significantly driven by what Netscape wanted. So Mozilla as a project developing a set of priorities separate from the company that was providing was paying 3/4 of the contributors was a little hard to do. I think the reasons that a lot of the non-Netscape contributors became involved in the project are similar to the priorities of the project today. But I'm not sure how much those priorities could... How much... To what extent you could say that those were priorities of the Mozilla project as a whole in 98. Although, again, it's a little hard for me to judge. I guess the priorities I'm thinking about when I'm saying this are, I guess, the top one is kind of keeping the internet open. In other words, keeping it based on open standards, keeping it preventing it from being dominated by one vendor. I think something that's kind of a newer priority is, I think, trying to improve the experience for end users, which I certainly think should be an important priority. But essentially, being user-driven is, to some extent, a business model. And that really wasn't so much Netscape's business model. They made money off of advertising, so they were trying, I guess, to... And this, you know, is really mostly an outsider's perspective on that, although I was an intern there for a bunch of summers. But I think Netscape was trying to maximize the amount of money they got from their advertising revenue. And I think in many cases, what Firefox was about was actually trying to produce the best browser for users. There are other incentives that we have, although I think the Mozilla Corporation's financial incentives are probably better aligned with making the product better for users than most other situations I could think of. I guess those two priorities, the first one is kind of coming out of the mission statement of the foundation, that is keeping, I think that the official statement is something like promoting choice and innovation on the internet. But we've had some discussions recently about what our big priorities should be. And I think the one that grabbed me the most was that we should be focused on what's better for the end user. And what's better for the end user is often what's better for other... When I say that, I'm thinking about that making things easier for authors is good for the end user because it means that authors have more time to produce whatever content the users are interested in and less time to worry about technical details of how to make it. And similar things for a lot of other areas. But I think actually having... It's one of the things that was brought up in discussions and one of the ideas that I really like about how we should think about our priorities. But I don't... I think that one actually has evolved more recently. And I think... was a big part of what originally drove Firefox. Even at that time, without any business model associated with it at all.
Thank you for listening this week. We'll be back in 2 weeks with highlights from an interview with Firefox co-founder Blake Ross. In the meantime, please help us collect the history of Mozilla, both from the developer and user perspectives. Visit mozillamemory.org or email us at mozmem@gmail.com. That's mozmem@gmail.com. And become a part of history by contributing your story to the Mozilla Digital Memory Bank.